You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello, Heat Nation. I'm David Romillo, credentialed reporter, the host of Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Please make sure to subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts to get the latest episodes. The Miami Heat looked a little sluggish to start off Thursday's Game 2 against the Boston Celtics, with the exception of Duncan Robinson, who once again regained his shooting stroke to help keep the game close. But the Celtics shot nearly 60% in the first half to build a 17-point lead, while Miami struggled to generate any easy offense. But in the third quarter, Bam Adebayo came to life, scoring 15 of his 21 points to help give the Heat a 7-point lead going into the final period. And while the Celtics were able to climb back on top, Miami got some clutch performances from Jimmy Butler and Goran Dragic to ice the game and win 106-101 and take a 2-0 lead over the Celtics in the Eastern Conference Finals. I'll give my key takeaways from the game and answer your listener questions in the last segment. But before getting to that, however, I just want to say what a huge win this was for Miami. Winning Game 1 was a great statement that while the Heat were considered underdogs by many of the national media, they absolutely had the ability to make this a competitive series. But you knew going into Game 2 that Celtics head coach Brad Stevens was going to make some adjustments, and with the possibility of adding Gordon Hayward soon, the Celtics just needed to get a win to tread water and regain some momentum. When they built a huge lead in the second and were getting some incredible shooting from Kemba Walker, who led Boston with 23 points, it seems like Stevens had found a key to success and to bring to life all of Miami's fears about Walker's scoring. Instead, the Heat and Eric Spoelstra, who continues to show he's the best coach left in the bubble and one of the top three coaches in the league, changed the game plan completely, stayed the course, and never lost composure or faith in his players as they responded with a gutty performance to take control of the series. While their ticket to the finals is far from punched, the Celtics have to win 4 of the next 5 games to defeat Miami, who improves to 10-1 in the playoffs after Thursday's win. That seems as daunting a challenge as you can imagine, because the Heat just never give up, and they do whatever is necessary to keep winning. In Game 2, it was the zone defense. After the game, Eric Spoelstra downplayed the zone, saying that we, as media, were looking for schemes or particular play calls to define the win, but that in his opinion, it was really just more about intensity and greater effort. Spo's being somewhat evasive here, trying to simplify things, as the team's Cooper Moorhead pointed out on Twitter that the Celtics scored 25 points on 32 possessions in which the Heat employed the zone. That's scoring just 0.78 points per possession. That's not too good. Spo's right, though, because Miami was lethargic early on. Both Bam Adebayo and Jimmy Butler were very passive, looking to get teammates going, passing up opportunities where they had defensive mismatches on them. Either there was an easy drive to the rim that they just wouldn't take, or when Jimmy was being guarded by the much smaller Kemba, they'd pass to an open teammate, and the Celtics did such a good job switching and closing out that would often result in a turnover or a highly contested shot. But somehow, both Jimmy and Bam found a way to make an impact later on. Jimmy is very fond of saying that he does not have to have a big performance in order for Miami to win. That's basically true. He was, offensively at least, struggling. 4 of 11 from the field, 0 for 1 from three-point range, 6 of 6 from the line, finishing with 14 points. Not even the kind of high-end production that we expect from him when he does all the other little things. 4 rebounds, 3 assists, 4 steals, however. Playing some excellent defense, and he is, of course, an elite defender and constantly harassing either Jason Tatum or Jaylen Brown, both who are all-star level scorers and capable of doing a fantastic job. But one of the things, again, that Butler always mentions is that he doesn't have to take up a huge scoring lead. And I think that was evident tonight, too, when almost everybody else had a big quarter and helped Miami kind of stay afloat and do what was necessary to contend with the Celtics throughout the game. In the first quarter, it was Duncan Robinson. He had a huge first. He went 4 of 9 in the first half, finished 6 of 12 overall, finishing for 18 points. And it was evident that Miami was trying to look to Duncan to get him going in the first quarter. They ran that play for him. They often do to start the game. Well, it was actually the second possession. The first possession was a Bam Adebayo hook shot over Daniel Tice that fell short. But Duncan got that first three to fall, connected on his next three attempts after that, just looked really, really good from behind the perimeter, seemed to have that stroke going and that confidence that is so essential for him to have a huge impact in the game. And that was just the kind of cushion that Miami needed. Every one of those points was necessary later on. And although Duncan wound up struggling late in the game and not having a huge level of production in the second half. In the first quarter, it was just enough. And while Miami, again, maybe as a team, that was their focus, trying to get Duncan going, trying to create that cushion, it was necessary. And that's all there is to it. I'm not sure if it was Spoelstra. I'm not sure if it was Jimmy. I'm not sure if whatever the factor was, it was evident that Duncan was trying to get going in the first quarter, that they were trying to make that a priority. And it was essential because, again, later on, he wound up struggling. But Miami still wound up getting enough production. In the second quarter, when Miami was really, really bad offensively, they finished with just 19 points. In game one, they had an 18-point first quarter. In quarter three, they had just 16 points. Well, they followed up that stinker with another one in the second quarter of tonight's game, where they finished with just 19 points overall. Nobody really seemed to put up a lot of scoring during that quarter other than anybody on the Boston Celtics, particularly Enes Kanter, who wound up having a major impact there. I tweeted this out during the game, and it was something that I had pointed out in my preview from just a few days ago with Locked On Celtics host John Corrales. I said I thought Kanter would go and become a factor, just as he always has been against the Heat when he was with the Knicks, when he was with the Thunder, even when he was with the Jazz during the early points in his career. It's always seemed like Kanter does such a good job of doing what he does well, which is getting rebounds, getting to the rim, having nice touch around the basket to put up points. And while he is absolutely a defensive liability for the Celtics, it didn't seem to matter because Bam was so passive. Kalinic was shooting mostly from the perimeter. So it's not that Kanter is bad defensively, but they also weren't attacking him the way they should have. If they were going to take advantage of a defensive mismatch, like I said earlier, then they have to actually attack it. They have to go at Kanter. They have to force him to foul trouble or get easy looks at the rim. They weren't doing any of that. They were just kind of basically running transition offense, not getting into any set, putting up some pretty questionable shot selection too. So it was an ugly second quarter for them offensively. And Kanter was able to go in there, provide some scoring for the Celtics, who wound up with 9 points, 4 of 4 shooting. It seemed like all that came in the second quarter. He played 11 minutes overall. And while there are, again, defensive issues when it comes to Kanter, offensively, he's always going to be able to get some points around the basket, and that was pretty evident in that quarter. However, Tyler did have a nice second. He finished 3 of 5 for 7 of his 11 points. He shot just 1 of 4 in the first quarter and 0 for 3 in the second half, so not making much of an impact later on, but it was just enough at the right time. Look, we spoke so highly about Tyler after game one, and deservedly so, because he did have the kind of courage and grit to be able to kind of continue to put up big shots and things of that sort. But in the first quarter, it seemed like he was forcing it a little bit, putting a little bit too much English when he was spinning these layups off of the glass, in traffic, contested shots that it didn't necessarily need to take, three-point attempts that were early in the shot clock. If there's a danger to what Tyler can do, you love the confidence. It's a fine line between confidence and overconfidence, where he's taking shots that he doesn't need to, and that's the problem. Look, you trust that Tyler and his offense are polished enough that eventually he's going to get those shots to fall or that he's going to make the right decisions. He did have some patience in key possessions later on. There was one moment there where it was just a flurry of bad shot taking, and Tyler pulled down the rebound, brought the ball back out beyond the arc, settled the offense, and let them get into their half-court set. And that's a kind of poise and maturity that you don't expect from a 20-year-old. But in the first quarter, that was not the case. He looked like he was trying to deliver the home run blow as opposed to just knocking in the single or driving home the next point, et cetera, et cetera. So in the third quarter, it was Bam. 7 of 8 overall, 15 of his 21 points. So aggressive. And it was just such a great effort from him. Not just was it an effort thing, though. There was a scheme that was being employed there that was so effective. They were running the pick and roll to death, particularly with Kemba Walker on Goran Dragic, and it was so effective. Daniel Theis, solid defender perhaps, but not able to contend with Bam's athleticism and speed. They did this. It was perfect. You look at the film, and I was reviewing all of Bam's shot attempts in the second half, particularly in that third quarter. It was so effective. He would just find a way to get Theis on his back there at a weird angle where he couldn't really contest when Goran was getting a high screen roll. Bam would step out, screen Walker, and then immediately curl around towards the rim. Theis would have to help off of Bam Adebayo to kind of protect Goran from getting to the rim, and then Walker would be curling behind Dragic. In the meantime, that would free up Bam completely to the rim where he'd get an easy dunk or a lob attempt or something along those lines. It was just a thing of beauty to see Bam being able to execute so perfectly. And that's what it is. You talk about execution all the time. Watch that third quarter. Watch those shots that he put up in the third. And that's absolutely all about execution. Meanwhile, in the fourth quarter, Goran dominated himself. 3 of 6 overall, 9 of his 25 points. A great performance from him. We haven't said enough about Goran because the points seem to come, not necessarily quietly, consistently might be the right word for it. He seems to find a way to keep scoring. Again, another 20-point game from him. When Jimmy continues to score or when Bam doesn't have that level of production, it seems like you always get it from Goran. Might not always be as effective, but in the fourth quarter, it was exactly what Miami need to help seal the win. Another great performance from him. 10 of 19 overall, 3 of 7 from three-point range, knocking in 3 rebounds and 5 assists to go along with those 25 points. The unsung hero of the game, and again, a great closer to have alongside Jimmy Butler, who you know can dominate, slow the pace down, and control the game. To have Goran out there is such an extra benefit for Miami, and probably a big reason why they'll be able to advance to the Eastern Conference, to the NBA Finals, and just 2 more wins. I'll continue breaking down Miami's big game to win over the Celtics and answer your questions about the game. You're listening to Locked On Heat. Subscribe to the show on your favorite app to listen to podcasts and always get the latest episode by asking your smart device to play Locked On Heat when you get in your car to get your team every day. I'll get into some more key takeaways of the game, but first some news. After the game, the NBA announced that Miami would play Game 4, which had previously been unscheduled, would go on next Wednesday. Game 3 is, of course, scheduled for Saturday at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time, and while the league wanted to keep an every-other-day schedule for the conference finals, the threat of competing against Monday Night Football and losing significant ratings was something they wanted to avoid. The Lakers and Denver Nuggets begin the Western Conference Finals on Sunday, so they'll play again on Tuesday, meaning that Miami's Game 3 is postponed until Wednesday. So that's a pretty significant gap there. I pointed it out on Twitter. Some people didn't seem to think it was that big a deal. I think it's a huge gap. Again, if game three is very important then to me, because now you have another opportunity to help impose your will on Boston. You have to be able to beat the Celtics in game three to create that cushion. It was so essential against the Bucks in the previous series. I think it's even more essential now, particularly with the possibility of Gordon Hayward coming back. I know a lot of people are saying, well, he's not ready. He's going to be a little rusty. Yeah, that's possible. Gordon's game isn't built on athleticism or anything like that. He's athletic enough, but he's also a solid shooter. He does all the little things well. He's an okay defender. He's a good rebounder. He gets to the line. He can absorb contact. He's strong enough. So my concern is that Miami's bench has been able to at least hold their own against Boston's bench. At least they did in game two. In game one, they got an unexpected boost from Brad Wanamaker that really eclipsed Miami's bench altogether, who continues to struggle. But moreover, if Hayward returns to action, either he's coming off the bench or he's inserted into the starting lineup, and then you bring Marcus Smart off the bench, there's options there that don't exist right now for Brad Stevens, and you want to limit whatever he can do. You don't want to give him extra tools for the toolkit. I think that's pretty obvious. And so my concern is that if he plays in game three and if the Celtics wind up winning that game, then you have 5 additional days off in between games 3 and 4, where you are able to take some of that extra momentum and figure out some way of stopping what Miami has been able to do well. You never want that to be the case. You want Miami to continue to build off the momentum they already have. You don't want Jay Crowder to regress or cool off. You don't want anything like that. And look, it's not necessarily a given that they'll cool off or that there'll be any kind of regression. You just want to try and avoid it whenever possible. But I do want to get into some key individual performances from Game 2. Unfortunately, Kendrick Nunn continues to struggle. In Game 1, just not much of a factor. Had some offensive output, but again, looks like he's struggling as a defender. He's not making plays for others, and that was the case in Game 2 as well. Maybe that second quarter didn't fall necessarily just to Kendrick. It wasn't about him, but he did wind up playing 5 minutes, all of which were in the second quarter. Wound up being 0-for-2. Just a plus minus 5, the team worst at that point. And, you know, that's an indicator. I think plus minus ratings are a little unclear. You can't always use them as an accurate gauge as to a player's performance or not. But I think even the eye test backs up that Kendrick just seems like he's not making much of an impact. And that's unfortunate because we did see some flashes where he was efficient as a defender and playmaker and trying to take the right shot against the Milwaukee Bucks, but against Boston, just not necessarily in the same kind of rhythm. I'm not sure if he's in the right headspace. I'm not sure what it is, to be honest with you. Look, you have to give some credit to the Celtics wing defenders. Either Smart or Brown or Tatum are capable of staying with a guy like Kendrick Nunn and challenging him into taking bad shots. And it doesn't take much to challenge Kendrick Nunn to taking a shot. And more often than not, it's going to be a contested one or a bad shot. He wound up curling around the rim at some point, taking a reverse layup when I think he had Jaylen Brown in him. That's a really bad match. It might have been Tatum. Either way, a guy much longer, much better known for their defense, and he's challenging him in a way. Like, you like Kendrick's, during the regular season anyway, you like Kendrick's aggression. You like his ability to say, you know what, I'm going to go look for my shot. I'm going to take it one way or the other. But especially in the second quarter when you're struggling for offense, you don't want to take a bad shot. That's just not all you need to do. Conversely, Derrick Jones Jr. probably had his best game of the playoffs. It seems like it's not necessarily on offense because he did struggle somewhat. He didn't score anything offensively. He didn't take a single shot. He was brought in there to be the linchpin of the zone defense, and it worked. He was so effective, switching constantly, moving around, getting into some strange fouls. Wound up getting called for a couple fouls that a lot of fans were wondering what he was doing. I thought those were really questionable calls, and he did not deserve to have those fouls called on him. I think he was challenging offensive players. He was criticized by Jeff Van Gundy and the broadcasting crew, but I think that was erroneous. I don't think that those were good calls whatsoever, and I think Derek just did such a great job providing another long-limbed, springy defender that can anticipate passes, break up passes, challenge you, get into your body a little bit, be physical, force you into bad shots, and it made such an impact, particularly in the third quarter when Miami's defense tightened so considerably and they held the Boston Celtics to just 17 points. I think Derek was a big part of it. I don't think he was the only reason why they were so effective, but to have him out there was a huge factor. And you look at the fact that he didn't even need to score a point in order to have a positive impact, and I think that's huge. And this is part of the consistency of this team, is that you have so many other players that could step up and do things right defensively, and as long as you get a good performance from him, I'm sorry, offensively, as long as you can get a good defensive performance from Derek, that's everything you might need. Fantastic night for him. Unfortunately, Andre Iguodala did not play much either, so I'm wondering if there's something going on there, because only wound up playing 7 minutes, and none of which were in the second half. Andre did not have it going. Just one assist, just didn't even take a field goal attempt. Again, brought out there mostly for his defense. You thought that you were going to be able to get something out of Andre in the series, if nothing else, just because he is another long-limb defender, a guy who breaks up passes and always seems to make the right play. But between the production of Jay Crowder, who continued to have another big night, not as efficient, 4 of 12 from the field, 3 of 10 from three-point range to go for 12 points, I don't know that you're necessarily going to need Andre scoring. At some point, it's going to come up either now or in the next series if you do wind up advancing past Boston. I don't like to get ahead of myself, but you do have to look ahead and see whether or not Andre has an opportunity to create or get some more playing time. It might not be against the Celtics. Who knows? At some point, somebody could get into foul trouble. You never know what could happen. And so it's always great to have a Swiss Army knife of versatility available to you. Speaking of versatility, another player who did struggle and has continued to struggle surprisingly in this series is Kelly Olynyk. Finished just 2 of 6 from the floor in his 13 minutes of play, 5 total points, 2 rebounds, no assists, no steals, no blocks. So an ugly, uneventful night for him. I think that's probably the best way of saying it. He thought maybe with Bam struggling in the first quarter that Kelly would have to go in there and feast a little bit. I keep thinking that that's going to happen, especially when he was going up against when Enes Kanter was in the game. I thought that was a perfect opportunity for Kelly to get himself going because he can drive past Kanter. He's got polish around the rim. He can take a great shot or make a pass against a Kanter or find a cutter or things of that sort. Just kind of ignite the offense in a way that Bam could not, at least in that first quarter. And that was the case. They brought Daniel Tice in right away, and he was able to at least stay with Kelly, move his feet well enough to challenge him. And Olynyk just never seemed to really get it going. I don't know if he was being particularly aggressive. I think it's also you look at what Boston does well and what Milwaukee couldn't do well, which was, you know, they couldn't guard the shooters. Boston does such a great job of doing so, and that kind of limits what Kelly can do as a playmaker. He's not going to get other players going if all of Boston's defenders are shutting them down. It was an interesting process to see it play out during the game, but I think Olynyk is still capable of having a big night, particularly offensively. And you'd like to see it at some point sooner rather than later. But right now, it doesn't seem like he can get that going against the Boston Celtics. Anyway, I'll answer some of the questions that you all submitted about Miami's big Game 2 win during the last segment. You're listening to Locked On Heat. One of the things you never have to answer any questions about is Built Bar, which is the best tasting protein bar I've ever had. I don't know if you've tried it at this point yet, but you are absolutely doing yourself a disservice. You should go to BuiltBar.com right now and try any one of their 18 amazing flavors. They've got so many great flavors. All the bars are covered in 100% chocolate. You won't be disappointed. There's so many different varieties, mixing in different varieties, flavors, all sorts of fruit additives, things that they could possibly make to improve what a protein bar. You don't even know it's a protein bar. They're so soft and easy to chew. The texture is great. The flavor is even better. And they're great for health conscious people. If you're looking to lose weight or maintain weight, the bars are low calorie, they're low sugar, high protein, high fiber, all the nutrients that you need. They're great for keto diet. To make sure you go and try all the different flavors that they have, you can build a box with just different assorted flavors. You won't be disappointed. Go to BuiltBar.com, use the promo code LOCKEDON, and you'll get $10 off your next order. If you want a quick, easy snack that'll keep you going, make you feel good, and taste great too, go to BuiltBar.com, use the promo code LOCKEDON, and get $10 off your next order at BuiltBar.com. Reminder that you can always reach me via email at lockedonheat@gmail.com or via Twitter using the hashtag AskLOHeat. I'll be getting into some of your listener questions that you submitted after the game using that hashtag. And this first question comes in from Steven, who asks, thoughts on Bam having an ineffective first half and then becoming a factor in the second? I don't know that there's anything to it. He kind of deflected the question a little bit. It was easy to see that Bam probably just didn't have an answer. I think, again, he's kind of feeding off of Jimmy's mindset that it's important to get other players going. And so he was a little passive. I'm not sure why he wasn't challenging Tice directly the way he should have in the first quarter or in the first half. But in the second half, they figured out a recipe, which was to use that high screen and roll with Kemba Walker to victimize him and take advantage of that mismatch. And it paid off. So we know why he was effective in the second half. Why he wasn't effective in the first half is probably a combination of bad scheming and bad effort on his part. Again, a little passive, not willing to take the shot when he had that mismatch available, looking to get other players going, making the right pass. And it's always a fine line for a player like Adebayo, who's such a great playmaker for others, that sometimes he winds up being a little too, not, you don't want to say unaggressive. He's just not necessarily looking for his shot. I think he feels better and feels like he's making more of an impact when he's getting other players going. And that makes sense. Look, if you want to have an egalitarian offense where you have everybody contributing at a high level, the only way you can do that is by sharing the ball. What's the expression? An assist is helps two people, or is a statistic for two people, because you know somebody else is scoring, but you also help them to get those easy points too. So maybe it's a little oversimplistic, but I think that's a big part of what drives Bam, is trying to get other people going, doing the little things. And look, it's made him a hell of a great player. He's the kind of player who can step up, have huge defensive stretches, even if he's not scoring or making plays for others. So that's a great, I think, impact of his, and the ability to make a huge imprint on the game without necessarily having to score a lot. But we hope to see a much more aggressive version of him later on, because I think it's just a better version of him. It works against the Celtics because they don't have much depth at the center position. Today, they tried Kanter. They didn't bring Robert Williams, the Time Lord, off the bench. They brought Grant Williams. Interesting tweet from Draymond Green of the Golden State Warriors, who has a keen analytical eye. He was able to figure out exactly what was going on with the Boston Celtics in the second half, particularly in that third quarter where Bam was going on. He said, take Kanter and Tice out of there. Bring Grant Williams, who is your rookie, And have him kind of gum up the works because he's a little bit smaller, a little bit more mobile, but stocky enough to kind of not necessarily hold his own, but at least roll and stay with the roll man when it's Adebayo in that pick and roll situation. Guess what? He was absolutely right. It wound up slowing everything down for Miami's offense. This next question, also from Steven, who comes in and says, what are your thoughts on the overall bench performance? Everyone, especially not named a baby goat, my thoughts are that as long as bench players don't dig a deep hole, you buy as much time as you can for the closers to get rest during the third quarters. Yes, I kind of hinted at it before. You want Tyler to be able to get going. I'm not sure what's going to happen with Andre. Kendrick is done. I really do believe that's the case. You want to be able to use that zone a little bit on occasion, and so Derrick Jones is going to get some minutes moving forward. That's been my thought from this point forward. Again, Kendrick is a guy who you go in there to hopefully restart or ignite the offense when it's really struggling. That hasn't been the case more often than not. And so at least go to your defensive presence, and that's with Derrick Jones Jr. It kind of has flattened everybody out in a way that maybe it's oversimplified how you perceive them to their basic strengths. Derek is a good defender, not a good offensive player. Kendrick is a good offensive player, not a good defensive player. And so you have them out there for specific situations where they can thrive and show off what they can do well. That's about it. As far as that is concerned, you hope that they figure it out and Kelly at least gets another game going, because I think he's versatile enough to make an overall impact. And while, you know, to Steven's points, you don't want to dig a deep hole, you also want to get some production out of them. And I think they're capable of it. I think Kelly in particular, who's had big nights against the Celtics during the past, perhaps during the regular season, I still think he can have a big night against them moving forward. So we'll see what can happen. This next question comes in from Jade, who asks, can Duncan continue this in the upcoming games? Yes. Flatly. I looked at all of his shots afterwards. He torched everybody, whether it was Kemba Walker, who just rose up because he's, you know, practically a foot taller than Kemba, or even the longer defenders like Tatum or Jaylen Brown, even Marcus Smart, who's known for his incredible defense. Duncan just did a great job of getting open, knocking down those shots. And I think the thing with Duncan is, and I continue to say this, you can see that the confidence is such a factor. If he's taking that first shot, it just seems more willing to take this shot and not looking to pass it up. And I, you know, you've heard by now the great stories about how a number of coaches at Sioux Falls, from Nevada Smith to Chris Quinn, etc., have drilled into him that he needs to be aggressive, to take that shot, to never pass it up. And you know that that's going to happen, but he also doesn't want to take a bad shot. And I think he has to walk that fine line, and he does a great job more often than not. But in game one, he just wasn't feeling it. He just didn't take that shot. He wasn't looking to take it. In game two, completely different story. And I think the play of the game for him was that shot where I think Adebayo kicked it out to the corner. And while it was contested, Duncan caught it at chest level, never brought the ball down, and just took a split second to release it with his pinpoint perfect accuracy. And it was just a beautiful shot that he knocked down. And that, I don't know if it's necessarily sustainable, but this is the strength of his game. This is what he does. He is a shooter. And if he's able to get those shots off against a variety of defenders that he did in game two, it's just a matter of being able to knock it down and hopefully building from his confidence as a result of this game. I don't think there's anything that Boston can do differently defensively to impact his shot. So yes, it's absolutely sustainable. Steve Kolakidis writes, 44% from the field and 32% from three isn't going to cut it going forward, but what a team. Do you think it was just an off night or Boston's defense? From what I could see, I think it was just poor shooting. No, I have to give some credit to Boston. Look, they do a great job switching. They do a great job defending and pressuring and challenging your shots, closing out to kind of at least show on your shots and to kind of, you feel their footsteps. You kind of hear them coming. And I think that puts a little pressure. And Jimmy in particular, a guy who does not get fazed very easily, he's being defended by multiple long-armed, long-limbed wing defenders. And I think that's going to be a difficulty for him moving forward. He's just not going to get those shots off. You saw the same things against Milwaukee when he had Wes Matthews pressure him all the time, body him up, harass him, stay with him. His focus was singularly on defense, and it worked in the Milwaukee series. I think similarly, you're getting either Jaylen Brown or Jason Tatum or a combination of those players that just kind of body up Jimmy, harass him a little bit, and keep him from getting to his comfort zone. And for Jimmy, at the very least, he's able to get to the line and draw contact and sell that contact effectively to the point where he's able to get to the line. So I think Boston's defense is a big part of what happened. And some of those shots, to Steve's point, however, they were open looks. He could have knocked those down. They could have knocked them down as a team that just didn't. So you hope that they'll be able to get it going, but you have to tip your hat to Boston's defense and recognize that they're doing a lot of things to put Miami on their heels and not get easy open looks. And it didn't pay off against Duncan today. Duncan had a big game, but again, eventually they tightened up how they stuck to him. A lot of those second half shots were a lot more closely defended. And I think we'll continue to see whether or not what team is able to execute most effectively moving forward. They're going to, again, that might seem overly simplistic to say, but it comes down to individual plays, individual levels of execution. And I think if Miami can find a way of getting certain players going, like they did Bam in the second quarter, in the third quarter, it's going to be all the difference. And hopefully they'll be able to get some hot shooting from other players. Stanley writes, how far out is Hayward and would they rush him for game three? We don't know that. There's not been any update. No, I don't think they would rush him. Too much at stake here. And again, with a longer layoff, between games three and four, no need to rush him back. If he's not at 100%, don't try him out there and re-aggravate that injury where you won't get anything out of them. Better to hold out and hope that everybody else can do enough. Look, I think Stevens, just like Spoelstra, is fond of the next man up theory. So they're not going to force Hayward out there, even though their potential season is at risk here. He also asks, Stanley does, why does the Heat keep finding themselves in early holes? Your guess is as good as mine. It takes them a while to kind of figure it out. I think a little part of it is Jimmy being the barometer for this team. His style is to kind of just assess, kind of look at what's going on, see what's necessary. They were a little passive, as I pointed out many times. I don't think that they always do this. I don't think they always find themselves in early holes. I think, you know, that wasn't the case against the Bucks. They just know how to turn things on at the right level in key situations. And I think it's hard to kind of play that level of defense that they do. When they tighten it as much as they do in the third quarter, that's a hell of a lot of effort for them. And I don't think it's easy for them to maintain that over the course of 48 minutes, which is why prior to the hiatus, we saw them blow double-digit leads. I think it's just difficult for them. We saw them build early leads early on. Recall what it was like prior to the bubble in late February and early March. They were building these huge leads in the first half, and then teams, bad teams, would come back and steal a win or challenge them where it came down to the fourth quarter. This is a different style of play. They're doing just enough in the first half and then turning it on at the right moments in the second half. So they flipped the switch in a way that I did not expect. I think that's pretty impressive. This last question comes from Recyclops, who asks, I know I'm getting ahead of myself here, but let's say the Heat win a championship this year. Does Pat Riley retire this offseason? Does he wait until 2021? Does Spo immediately become the GM? Okay. No, Spo does not become the GM. I cannot see him doing that at this point in his career. He's young. He's still energetic. He likes the coaching. He likes the nitty-gritty breaking down things. He's not going to become the GM anytime soon. Does Riley retire after 2021? No, I think he still likes this as well. I think this whole process, if they win a title this year, he's so energized by this and the possibility of adding any superstar like Giannis or something else, I think that will be his next major impact is to get those players and to say, okay, I've done this, I've signed them, now it's up to somebody else. I don't know if there's anybody else. I guess they would probably bring somebody in internally. I guess Shane Battier is a very good option. So that's my guess anyway. Sorry, Recyclops. I don't see Pat Riley retiring anytime soon, at least not yet. And Spo will maintain his role as coach because I just think he doesn't want a dual role. I think he would be good at it, but I just don't think he wants that kind of role right now. Not at this point. Maybe 10, 15 years down the line, he wants another challenge because he does like to keep himself uncomfortable. He likes to kind of do new things and try new things. So I could see him becoming a general manager at some point, but not a coach right now. He's a coach right now, and he's going to stay that way. Coming up later this week, I'll be talking to Rob Mahoney of The Ringer about his piece on Duncan Robinson and his evolution. Plus, of course, I'll be covering Game 3 and bringing you a recap of that one. Be sure to subscribe and follow this podcast to get the latest episode of Locked On Heat as soon as it's out. I'm David Ramil signing off and thanking you, as always, for your support.